Right, maybe I'll start in French and the rest will be in English. As a symbol for the fact that I'd like to mention a translation also, so this is has to be highly symbolical. D'abord, merci à tous d'être là, et puis vraiment c'est un grand plaisir pour moi de recevoir dans notre séminaire Aliénation et Émancipation Claire Deligny, que je vais vous présenter très 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 bientôt. Et David Allen, qui nous a fait l'honneur d'accepter d'être le discutant, répondant, je ne sais pas trop comment on dit ça, mais pour cette séance. Alors, cette séance va être consacrée à l'asile victorien, Alienation, Emancipation and the Lunatic Asylum Model, qui est un sujet qui, comme chacun sait, me tient à cœur. Claire Deligny est docteur en histoire britannique ou civilisation britannique. On ne va pas rentrer dans le débat, je ne sais pas quelle est ta position sur ce sujet. De l'université Paris Diderot. Donc sa thèse porte un très joli nom, The Borderlands of Insanity, Folie et pauvreté dans les asiles du Lancashire, trois asiles, de 1845 à 1914. La communication de ce soir est dans la lignée en fait, de ce travail de recherche sur les archives de ces trois asiles. Et elle est actuellement enseignante à Paris-Sud-Saclay. Elle est étudiante en médecine et pharmacie, si j'ai bien compris. Donc,
pharmacie.
Donc tout est très, tout se tient. Voilà. Et avant d'écouter Claire, je vous présente aussi David Allen. David Allen a la particularité d'être né à Vienne et d'avoir vécu à Londres et d'être parisien. Donc, moi, je trouvais que ça c'était bien comme particularité. Une bonne raison pour l'inviter. Une meilleure raison encore pour l'inviter. Donc, David Allen est psychologue clinicien. Il est maître de conférences à Rennes 2 en psychopathologie. Mais aujourd'hui, il se consacre à tout un tas d'activités, me semble-t-il. Son activité de psychothérapeute et son activité de chercheur, essentiellement sur l'histoire de la psychiatrie. C'est ce qui a fait qu'on s'est rencontrés, d'ailleurs. Alors, il est l'auteur de nombreux livres, dont je vais vous présenter rapidement, parce qu'il est vraiment lié à ce qu'on va voir ce soir. Il est l'auteur d'un livre, moi j'en retiens deux parmi de nombreux ouvrages, « Critique de la raison psychiatrique », Éléments pour une histoire raisonnée de la schizophrénie, qui est paru en 2015, pour pouvoir faire circuler. Et puis, un livre très récent, qui est paru il y a quoi, 3-4 mois, je ne sais plus, 6 mois, qui est très original, parce que c'est une traduction d'une sorte de carnet d'asile, en fait, de quelqu'un qui s'appelle James Frame, et qui était un patient dans un asile écossais, l'asile de Gardnavel. Avec une petite équipe, David Allen a fait un travail remarquable, je trouve, de traduction pour arriver à transmettre en fait à un public français, enfin un lectorat francophone, ce texte qui est quand même très peu connu en France, il faut le dire, jusqu'à présent, un peu plus connu en Angleterre, un peu plus connu en Angleterre, et qui avait eu un certain retentissement à l'époque où il était sorti, c'est-à-dire en 1860. Ce travail en fait sur les asiles qui nous a réunis. Et c'est d'autant plus précieux, en fait, et peut-être que tu vas le mentionner, Claire, mais que les témoignages de patients, on n'en a pas beaucoup. Voilà. Surtout sur les proper lunatic asylums. C'est vraiment hyper rare, d'où vraiment l'intérêt de les mettre en valeur. Voilà, je vais me taire et nous allons écouter Claire Deligny, donc pendant une petite. Et ensuite, oui, David Allen prendra le relais sur quelques questions, et puis ensuite la parole sera à vous.
Thank you. So back to English then.
Back to English.
Mike, thanks very much. I'd like to start by thanking the Aliénation et Émancipation team, I guess, for having me today, as well as David Allen for accepting to be my respondent today as well. All right, I'm actually going to start with a quotation, which is quite a long one, but I swear it's worth it. In 1916, the Lancaster County Asylum in Lancashire, in the northwest of England, celebrated its centenary and the opening of a new section of the Lunatic Asylum based on a relatively new architectural model known as the Villa Model. The centenary of the asylum was the opportunity for the asylum authorities to show the institution as quite literally a museum of madness, which allowed them to trace back the history of the institution and more generally, the history of the treatment of the insane. Dr. Cassidy, medical superintendent of the Lancaster County Asylum, provided members of the Lancaster Corporation, who inspected the newly erected villa for private female patients on Wednesday, with an effective illustration of the revolution which has been effected in the treatment of lunatics during the 100 years the asylum has been in existence. In the cosy waiting room of the villa was a collection of saddlery, which made the visitor wonder if they had strayed into a harness room, but it was subsequently explained that the instruments were relics of the old barbarous days of restraint, when lunatics were tied up in strong leather straitjackets, when they were leg-locked and handcuffed and locked to walls, when, if they were given to biting, a leather muzzle was fitted to their face, and when they were incarcerated for years together in warm rooms and forbidden the company of their fellows. Outside this room, however, all is brightness and freedom. The villa, indeed, might be described, not incorrectly, as a palace, for there are thousands of homes in the County Palatine which do not contain a tithe of the delights furnished by the latest addition to the public institutions of Lancaster. Now, the history of the asylum and of the treatment of the insane described here is hinged upon a rhetoric of progress, going from restraint, violence, and bad treatments to an enlightened era of freedom, brightness, cleanliness, and even to some extent luxury here at the start of the 20th century. In other words, from alienation to emancipation. It is this discourse that I would like to examine and deconstruct today as part of a wider reflection on the elaboration of an asylum model in the long 19th century. A few things on the background first. By the beginning of the 20th century, indeed, lunatic asylums had become part of the typical institutional landscape in the English counties, alongside workhouses and prisons. This followed an 1845 set of lunacy laws, which had made it compulsory for the counties to erect public asylums, that is to say, to be financed by public taxes, local taxes. This legislation gave rise to the construction of a series of public asylums throughout Britain in the second half of the century, a period known since Andrew Scull as the era of asylumdom. Now, for the purpose of this study, I will focus on three public institutions in Lancashire. So you've got first the Lancaster Asylum, one of the first public institutions in England, established in 1816. The Asylum of Rainhill, near Liverpool, which opened in 1851. Same as Prestwich, near Manchester. These were later completed with two other asylums at Whittingham in 1873 and Winwick in 1902. So before moving to the study of these asylums, let me say a few words on the theoretical framework and the definitions of alienation and emancipation I will be using in this paper. The use and overuse of these flag words both point at their rich conceptual contents and the necessity for a clear definition. It is difficult to take them separately. However, their meaning, when taken as a binary concept, is also polysemic. So here to simplify, alienation literally designates the process by which someone is made other or alien. This estrangement can be understood on several interrelated levels. The ontological level first, one can be alien to oneself. That could be a definition for insanity, which translates into French as aliénation mentale. It can be also social. One can be alien in society through one's dependence to structures and norms outside oneself. So this corresponds to the traditional Marxist definition of alienation. Both meanings rely on Laboisi's naturalist assumption that there is a pre-existing natural self that has been corrupted. In this perspective, emancipation could mean several things. In the ontological sense, emancipation would be the return to one's supposedly true self or true nature. So it would equate a form of de-alienation or a cure. In the social sense, emancipation would be the movement whereby the alienated frees himself or herself from a series of social, political, and/or legal restraints once again to regain something of a natural form of liberty. So that would be emancipation as liberation. And that's the definition used by social studies since the 1960s with emancipation of workers, of women, and so on. It's interesting here to note two things. First, these two layers, ontological and social, and especially when it comes to alienation, are actually combined in the figure of the insane, who is both diagnosed, named other, and potentially socially and physically ostracized. Secondly, it is also worth noting that when we take emancipation as meaning liberation, the alienated does not necessarily remove all of his or her constraints. In other words, emancipation can be partial. The alienated can free themselves from certain aspects of their lives. In that sense, the individual is always caught between autonomy and heteronomy, between liberation and a certain form of alienation. Now, this echoes our initial statement from the Lancaster County Asylum, which manages to reconcile the notions of confinement and liberation. The insane patients were freed from physical coercion and might manage some form of autonomy within constrained structures. Now, this tends to undermine any total theory of emancipation and also questions the nature of the relations between alienation and emancipation. Now, in this paper, I will argue that the different ways in which we comprehend the articulation between alienation and emancipation represent different yet complementary readings of the treatment of the insane and of the asylum model. So I'm going to start with, well, what I call the rhetoric of emancipation in the first half of the 19th century. So first, the move from alienation to emancipation, well, if we understand it as a move between the two notions, as is manifest in our initial quotation, participates in teleological narratives of mental institutions. And this relies on contemporary definitions of progress. This echoes, for example, Condorcet's perception of progress as a movement towards freedom and equality. To put it differently, progress was hinged upon, and I'm just rephrasing Taguieff's definition here, was hinged upon the conception of a historical process which is inevitably heading towards a superior aim. This is in fact very accurate to describe what I will refer to here as the rhetoric of emancipation. Liberating the insane became a topos at the beginning of the 19th century. And this corresponded both to a redefinition of insanity and a redefinition of treatment, which I will very briefly cover here. So, indeed, at the start of the 18th century, insanity was still considered an obscure territory, a wild, uncultivated region, an intellectual Africa that abounds with an endless variety of monsters and irregular minds, as Sir Blackmore put it. Now, this is both telling of the state of knowledge on mental diseases, seen as incurable forms of degradation, and of the ways in which the insane were to be considered as animals or brutes. This, of course, had an impact on the management of the insane, which was dominated by violence and coercion, encapsulated in the term restraint. The idea of the insane as bestial is perhaps best remembered through popular images associated with Bedlam, which opened in the 13th century in London. Now, there have been numerous readjustments regarding treatment at Bedlam and its evolution, but there is a certain persistence in the popular conceptions of Bedlam, associating insanity and bestiality and portraying a correspondingly bestial treatment. In the 18th century, the development of other theories on the nature of insanity alongside the traditional humoral theories contributed to redefinitions of insanity. This actually corresponded to the development of organogenesis, so that is to say a physical cause or physical etiology of insanity. So at this period, for instance, neurology started to develop with William Cullen, and also the development of psychological explanations of insanity. The turn of the 18th century coincided with psychological explanation of insanity, and this is often illustrated with a 1758 monograph from William Batty, one of the first to deal exclusively with insanity, treating it as a separate entity and criticizing the treatment of the insane at Bethlehem. These evolutions are sometimes summed up under the controversial term of medicalization of insanity, which I'm just using here for the sake of clarification, I guess, whereby insanity started to be recognized as a pathology. Now, these organicist and psychological explanations of insanity contributed to redefinitions of insanity, of course, but also of treatment. The 18th century is thus best associated with the rise of moral treatment, which relied on one naturalist assumption, which is really crucial to understand, that move from alienation to emancipation. Insanity was the alienation of one's sane self, which could still be retrieved. In other words, insanity was curable. Moral treatment gained popularity when it came to be practiced and theorized by the Tukes, a Quaker family which founded a private institution known as the York Retreat in 1796. Now, moral treatment is very hard to define by the contemporaries, just as for the historians, actually, but its main principles were twofold. A physiological treatment that would be reached by placing the insane in a protected and healthy environment, and then a real moral treatment, or psychological treatment, regulating the insane's conduct. Essentially, the retreat rejected contemporary violent treatments, a practice for which another local institution, the York Asylum, was known for. So an emphasis on the environment of the insane, with work and entertainment as main activities, made the retreat famous. The retreat became one of the founding myths of modern psychiatry. Visits from foreign alienists, together with the publication of Samuel Tuke's A Description of the Retreat in 1813, turned the Quaker institution into a model to be imitated elsewhere. And around the same period in France, you have Philippe Pinel, who was similarly creating his own legend of the man liberating the insane from their shackles in Bicêtre. So this is where we can see the first signs of a move from alienation to emancipation, seen as part of the progressist rhetoric which characterized the rest of the 19th century. The insane would be freed from an alienating discourse, equating insanity and bestiality, and the emphasis would be put on the etiology and on the curability of insanity. Whether in reality these movements could actually be seen as emancipatory is, of course, to be questioned. Moral treatment at the retreat, for instance, did not mean a clean break from physical restraint. Abolition of restraint came decades earlier, in the 1830s, with a movement known as the non-restraint movement, which meant to abolish violent forms of treatments. So the application of this principle, in particular by John Connolly, meant to prove that a non-violent treatment was applicable in institutions which were rigorously managed and properly trained attendants. So liberating the insane, therefore, was associated with them being institutionalized. In the 1830s, 1840s, these redefinitions meant that the lunatic asylums went, at least theoretically, from places of custody to places of cure. This resulted in the emergence of a new profession and a new asylum model. Perhaps one of the best-known illustrations, William Brown, the medical superintendent at the Montrose Asylum in Scotland and a proponent of moral treatment, formulated a model of the asylum in a series of lectures in 1837. A perfect asylum may appear to be a utopia, a sight to dream of, not to see. But near approaches have been made to what reason and humanity point out as the standard of excellence. From these and from that standard itself, materials may be obtained for the construction of a model which may serve to show how far distant we still are from what must be the object of every enlightened mind and by what means that object is to be arrived at. In Brown's progressist rhetoric, the model is both a prototype and an ideal type which, you know, British asylums should try to imitate. Brown's ambitious asylum model reflected contemporary reformers' redefinitions of the asylums. So they were not to be places of confinement, and thus they had to be clearly distinguished from other institutions like workhouses or prisons. Brown's lyrical description of the modern asylum gives us an idea of the contemporary therapeutic optimism. Conceive a spacious building resembling the palace of a peer, airy and elevated and elegant, surrounded by extensive swelling grounds and gardens. The interior is fitted up with galleries and workshops and music rooms. The sun and the air are allowed to enter at every window. The view of the shrubberies and fields and groups of labourers is unobstructed by shutters or bars. All is quiet, clean, quiet, and attractive. The inmates all seem to be actuated by the common impulse of enjoyment. All are busy and delighted by being so. The house and all around appears a hive of industry. There is in this community no compulsion, no chains, no whips, no corporal chastisements, simply because these are proved to be less effectual means of carrying any point than persuasion, emulation, and the desire of obtaining gratification. So very interestingly here, therefore, Brown reconciles the emancipation of the insane and their confinement in asylums. And this conflation is crucial to our understanding of Victorian asylums. Now, this is, of course, characteristic of the reformers' rhetoric. And even among them, Brown's, you know, lyrical style was really criticized. The actual lunacy legislation passed in the first half of the 19th century was based on a syncretism between these humanitarian principles and a utilitarian argument. So in 1808, a first permissive piece of legislation thus allowed the local magistrates to erect institutions funded through local taxes. In 1845, this construction was made compulsory in the boroughs and counties, and a central inspectorate, the Commissioners in Lunacy, was also set up and was in charge of inspecting public, private, and charitable institutions to avoid abuses in the treatment of the insane. These aimed at rationalizing the management of the insane, in keeping, in fact, with numerous social reforms passed in the 1830s. Still, for the reformers, the new legislation meant new opportunities to develop civilized moral models of asylums. And for Daniel Hacktuke, who was part of the Quaker family, the 1845 legislation was, and I quote, the Magna Carta of the liberties of the insane. So we can see here that the rhetoric of emancipation in the first half of the century coexisted with utilitarian considerations regarding the management of the insane. Neither the models presented by the reformers nor the 1845 legislation were prescriptive, however. So let's see how these principles were applied locally in one of the most populated counties in England, Lancashire. Right, so Lancashire is an interesting case study, particularly as it presents one of the first public asylums in Britain, the Lancaster Asylum, which actually was erected after the 1808 permissive law and opened in 1816. In the 1840s, Lancaster actually had to be reformed along the relatively new principles defended by the non-restraint movement. Conversely, the asylums at Rainhill and Prestwich were opened in 1851, and so they were already built after the new therapeutic model. Now, annual report from Rainhill, annual reports from Rainhill reveal the attention paid to the site, the architectural style, with a careful description of the rooms and of the asylum's grounds. Both Prestwich and Rainhill actually adopted a lineal plan, which had been recommended by John Connolly, with a main central building, which you might see here, containing the superintendent's quarters, a meeting room, attendance room, and a common room for the patients of both sexes. And in both cases, the chapel, which you can see, this is the little square here, was detached from the rest of the building. And the superintendent at Prestwich actually noted that the detached chapel created a link between the asylum and the rest of the community. Attention was also paid to the environment. Asylum grounds were carefully designed, and the view from the asylums were also taken into consideration with the use of sunk fences. As is mentioned in the first report for Rainhill, being separated from the adjoining fields by a sunk fence, the great advantage is gained that no obstruction is offered to the view, and the appearance of confinement within its walls is very much diminished. At Rainhill, the local committee of visitors not only resorted to architects, but also landscapists. So this is why you have a sort of large winding path, and you've got pleasure gardens and kitchen gardens, really well organized. Decoration inside and outside the asylum was also presented as part of the curative nature of the asylum. Asylums were in fact meant to evoke a domestic, middle-class atmosphere. And this is also what Daniel Hagtuk referred to as homishness, which he defined as the desire to make it a family as much as under the peculiar circumstances of the case is possible. So it is this model that the asylum at Lancaster had to adjust to in the 1840s. Now, problem, the asylum at Lancaster had not been built upon the principles of moral architecture. In 1816, the building was a simple square of about 65 yards, initially meant for the confinement of 120 patients, with 5 acres of asylum grounds around it. The asylum was reformed in 1840, when Dr. Samuel Gaskell became its superintendent and was assisted by Dr. Devitre. In 1840, in their first report, they underlined the poor state of the asylum and methods of treatment they deemed completely outdated. We'll come back to the plan afterwards. So at the time your officers took charge, they found 29 persons wearing either handcuffs, leg locks, or straight waistcoats, exclusive of between 30 and 40 patients who were chained down during the daytime on seats so constructed as to answer all the purposes of water closets in rooms known by the appellation of warm rooms. Now, to these remarks were added other considerations on the number of the insane confined in the building, 500 for a building conceived for 100 patients, poor hygiene and inappropriate drainage. The plan, actually, so this is the plan, a plan from 1842, so it was already slightly reformed, but you can still see the difference from the other plan. The plan also shows high walls surrounding, so we've got a boundary wall surrounding the institution, which reinforced the impression of confinement and contrasted with the sunk fences used elsewhere. Gaskell and De Vitre repeatedly asked for more asylum grounds to enable the patients to work and play in the open air. They also stressed the necessity for a better classification of patients. And in 1843, the Lancaster Asylum acquired 35 additional acres of land, so 1 year after this. The window bars also ended up being removed, and the wall surrounding the asylum was torn down. The old structure remained and thus coexisted with new buildings erected along the lines of the new therapeutic principles mentioned earlier. In 1842, Constant Crommelinck, who came to England as part of a European tour of lunatic asylums for the Belgian crown, thus commented on his visit at Lancaster. Dans le nouveau quartier, tout respire un air de bien-être qui se manifeste dans la physionomie du malade comme dans ses moindres gestes. Le bonheur semble semer sous ses pas, il n'a qu'à le cueillir à pleine main. Il vient au-devant du visiteur, lui adresse des paroles aimables, gaies, spirituelles, et montre avec emphase le travail auquel il se livre. De l'autre côté de l'établissement, c'est le revers de la médaille. Le malade est morne, triste, silencieux, semble rêver à des projets de haine et de vengeance. Sa physionomie inspire de l'effroi. Il jure, parle constamment avec colère, insulte le visiteur comme le médecin, et comme poussé par l'instinct de l'injustice, il proteste contre son séjour dans cette prison et ses protestations pour celui qui doit les endurer ou les craindre. Là, le malade est plein de santé et de vigueur. Ici, il s'étiole, le dévoiement l'entraîne souvent au tombeau. D'un côté, ils guérissent, tandis que de l'autre, ils tombent en démence si la mort ne vient de les délivrer. Now, Crommelinck's dual description perfectly illustrates the progressive rhetoric as the two models seemed to coexist in the Lancaster Asylum. Now, this contrast between the old and new parts actually also raises the question of the conditions in which moral treatment was introduced in our asylums. Now, all three asylums adopted the main principles of moral treatment, with a stress on both work and entertainment. These included regular walks in the parks, balls, but also exceptional events such as outings in the neighbouring cities for a few selected patients. The asylums were depicted in idealistic terms in the local press in the 1850s, 1860s. Of particular interest is a poem published in the freshly launched Liverpool Daily Post in 1855, only 4 years after the opening of Rainhill. This poem was supposedly written by a patient who detailed Whit Monday activities such as dances and games played by the patients together with the doctors and attendants. The patient describes this surreal, somewhat carnivalesque scene. Each chase was a source of much pleasure and laughter. One chase I observed, it was rather uncommon, I saw our young doctor chased by an old woman, who caught him and gave him a tip or a whack, that very soon frightened the runaway back. A patient observed that although it was play, he should get a good shower bath for running away. Now, the grotesque scene of a doctor being chased by an old woman and threatened to be administered a cold bath by a patient is meant to underline the close relations between the doctors and the patients, as well as the acceptance of the asylum rules, here replicated by the patients themselves. This partook on the rhetoric of emancipation I have referred to earlier and seems to demonstrate how the attendants and the patients themselves supposedly embraced moral treatment. In addition to work and entertainment, sports such as cricket were also valued, together with various aspects of the patient's environment and appearance, dress, for instance. This also coincided with the social ambition of moral treatment. In this sense, the asylum was less perceived as a refuge than as a space for moral, mental, and social rehabilitation. As Henry Higgins, the chaplain for the Rainhill Asylum, recommended, the name asylum, meaning safe from spoil, very imperfectly expresses all that an asylum ought to be. Industrial employment is the chief resource, and of forms of employment, that is best which combines the largest number of sanitary correctives. So the transformative meaning of emancipation, therefore, was also social in this sense. Now, beyond the linear narrative of asylum confinement as progress, one can wonder about the practicalities of moral treatment. There were, in fact, many obstacles, both practical and ideological, to the application of moral treatment. This was unsurprisingly the case at Lancaster, with signs of a very difficult transition for the insane patients, but also for the attendants. As Samuel Gaskell stressed in 1845, in addition to the resistance to change which clings to all old establishments, innumerable obstacles had to be overcome, owing to the various alterations and enlargements conducted at a time when accommodation could scarcely be afforded to the inmates crowded within its walls. No adequate idea can be conveyed of the anxieties felt or the amount of mental and bodily exertion required in carrying out a milder system of treatment amidst the noise, confusion, and exposure to danger consequent on extensive alterations in a building in which the insane are confined and in which the efforts of the superior officers are not cheerfully seconded by those placed under them. Interestingly here, Gaskell points at technical difficulties as well as signs of resistance. First, difficult conditions and in particular overcrowding undeniably led to transgressions of moral treatment. This was the case, not only the case at Lancaster, actually, but also at Prestwich and Rainhill throughout our period. Prestwich actually encountered difficulties from its very opening in January 1851, as the asylum superintendent, Joseph Holland, lamented on the fact that they had had to admit 428 patients while the asylum was still under construction. And he uses this as an argument to justify restraint. Now, in the same way, signs of resistance were to be found across the three asylums. Now, while resistance, just like emancipation, suggests a form of autonomy, It is essentially negative, and so it contrasts with the transformative nature of emancipation. In this case, the attendance resistance in particular was an obstacle to the necessary progress of treatment. Gaskell's remark is more generally indicative of the difficulties connected with the management of attendance. At Prestwich, the superintendent Holland also lamented on the fact that the attendants did not understand their duties. And moral treatment, of course, did lead to redefinition of their functions, which is perhaps best summed up in the terminological change in the Lancaster reports from keeper to attendant. However, while the training for hospital nurses was being developed, there was no formal training for asylum attendants. And so for this reason, several brochures produced by the asylum specify their duties. In 1846, a brochure for the asylum at Lancaster defined the attendants as patient and indulgent, never to insult or to be violent against patients. And Gaskell and de Vitré also reported gathering their attendants to explain to them, in very simple terms, the tenets of moral treatment. Now, there were later brochures at Rainhill and Prestwich, which similarly pointed at the requirements of a function which was both poorly paid and very demanding. And in fact, the degree for attendants was only created at the end of the 19th century, so a bit later. Now, in practice, forms of transgressions, and in particular violence against patients, obviously remain part of asylum life, although they are much more difficult to trace. Cases of autopsies on patients found to have broken ribs, for example, were often exposed in the press and led to several local and national scandals. To take but one example, the poem we saw earlier, dated August 1855, was published 4 months after Patrick Murphy, an attendant at Ringhill, was charged with violently assaulting a crippled patient. And so the poem actually ended with a celebration of the attendants who strove, and I quote, to teach the pale lips long accustomed to sigh to kiss rosy-lipped clouds on futurity's sky. In this light, this ideal description of moral treatment does sound like an attempt to correct the public image or to rectify the public image of the asylum. In the same way, and contrary to the image encouraged by the poem, acts of resistance coming from the patients were also very common. Although it is very difficult, as you were saying, to retrieve the insane's voices, reports are filled with references to destruction of property, windows, for instance, or violent acts against other patients, attendants, or even superintendents. And maybe more characteristically, escapes were also mentioned regularly. Now, interestingly, the asylum authorities integrated the escapes into the ideal narratives of moral treatment. The medical superintendent for Rainhill in 1847, Cleeton, thus used this argument after 3 successful escapes. The escape of an occasional patient is an incidental result of the more modern asylum arrangements, where the unobtrusive vigilance of the attendants is expected to take the place of high walls and barred windows. And it is better that an irregularity of this kind, which is occasionally scarcely avoidable, should occur, than that the liberty of the general mass of patients be curtailed by mechanical means and the remedial influence, thus be loss of confidence imposed and self-control exercised. So other aspects, of course, tend to disrupt the very linear narrative of moral treatment. For example, the use of medication or the use of classification. And so we can see, in fact, that it's very important in this context to understand moral treatment both as a practice and a discourse, a concept encapsulated in the Foucauldian term of a discursive practice. As a discourse, moral treatment seemed to imply uniformity. As a practice, however, moral treatment was actually pragmatic and diverse. Still, this rhetoric tends to present the asylums as total institutions. And so I'm going to say a few words about their insertion in the institutional landscape of that period, which enables us to qualify this definition. Right, so the progressive rhetoric encouraged by the asylum authorities in fact, was consistently undermined by competing forms of management of the insane. And I will be insisting here on the relations between the asylum institutions and the poor law institutions. The lunatic asylums actually heavily relied on the poor law system, and in particular on one of the most characteristic institutions in Victorian Britain, the workhouse. The asylums and the workhouses were theoretically established on completely opposite principles. The asylums, as we've seen, were grounded upon the ideal of cure. However, the workhouses relied on a punitive definition of confinement. Based on the supposed congruence between pauperism and immorality, the 1834 New Poor Law had, in particular, restricted outdoor relief. So institutionalization in explicitly difficult conditions was made more systematic for paupers needing assistance. So that's for the poor law. Now, despite this, there was, in fact, an institutional continuity between the poor law and the lunatic asylums. Lunatics had to be registered as paupers to be admitted into lunatic asylums. We're still talking about public asylums. Similarly, the procedures related to admissions were actually not in the hands of the asylum authorities, but in the local guardians, so the local poor law authorities. In practice, many pauper lunatics were first admitted into workhouses, and sometimes they even stayed there. The reasons for keeping lunatics in workhouses instead of transferring them were first and foremost related to one pragmatic argument that is not very often mentioned by the reformers: cost. For the local guardians, it was actually about four times less expensive to keep a lunatic in a workhouse than in a lunatic asylum. Now, despite this theoretical opposition, the asylum authorities also had to rely on workhouses as alternatives, especially as they quickly became overcrowded. And at Rainhill, for instance, there is a very informative correspondence between the asylum authorities and the Brownlow Hill workhouse in Liverpool in 1856, which reveals this dilemma. On the one hand, the curative ideal made it impossible for the asylum authorities to accept the confinement of the insane in workhouses. On the other hand, the asylum had had to refuse many patients that year. And so after lengthy exchanges, the Rainhill Asylum authorities had to conclude in 1857, on principle, the committee object to the confinement of lunatics in workhouses, but having to refuse many recent cases and being much pressed by the workhouse authorities in Liverpool, they consented to discharge, as a temporary expedient only, some half dozen patients. This early concession is actually quite representative of the reality of the management of the insane. While opposed by principle, the workhouses and the asylums were in fact both rival and complementary institutions, which completely undermines the rhetoric of emancipation discussed earlier. And this also tends to qualify the definition of the asylums as total institutions, or the only ones in charge of the insane. So these are figures I retrieved from the archives, and actually it shows, I mean, as you can see, that the Asile d'Indigent, so the workhouses, actually played a big part in the management of the insane, not the treatment. And as we can see here, the Lancashire asylums only gradually became the first institutions to receive insane patients. In practice, the Lancashire asylums had contracts with local workhouses, which enabled bilateral exchanges of patients. So why the rhetoric of emancipation mentioned earlier corresponded to a humanitarian definition of asylum treatment, we can see that in reality, the management of the insane was constantly negotiated at a local level. Now, there is a very good illustration of this, which is the competing rhetorics that we can find in the local press. In the local press, the ideal descriptions of the lunatic asylums and scenes of moral treatment were in sharp contrast with the comments emanating from the poor law authorities or the local boards of guardians. The latter often criticized the cost of these institutions for the local taxpayers, to whom the aspects of moral treatment, and for example the stress on decoration, sounded like a provocation. The expression palaces for the insane were thus often used in the press to denounce the increasing weight of the asylums on the local taxes. Now, these pragmatic considerations also allowed the local guardians, so part of the poor law authorities, to explicitly undermine confinement at the asylums, denying both the alleged freedom of patients and the curative aspect of treatment. So a well-documented instance of the tensions between the asylums and the poor law authorities is to be found in a two-month correspondence between the Committee of Visitors of the Prestwich Asylum and the Bolton Board of Guardians in 1872. The letters were prompted by various statements made by the chairman of the Board of Guardians during two meetings which were published in a local newspaper, the Bolton Chronicle. One of these statements read, "So when a person went to Prestwich, if he was useful and made a good gardener or such like, he could not get out. It was a fact and he knew it. He had seen persons there as sane as himself that day. At Prestwich, the asylum authorities were concerned with this bad publicity in the local press, completely contradicting their liberal definition of asylum institutions. And so a letter sent by the Committee of Visitors to the Bolton Board of Guardians required the chairman to duly justify his accusations. And after lengthy exchanges, the case was finally settled when the chairman revised his statements in the press. Although the asylum authorities had threatened to publish the correspondence in the press, the Committee of Visitors for Prestwich edited it into a pamphlet instead, with the avowed aim of, I quote, correcting erroneous impressions which have been produced in the minds of the relatives and friends of the patients. Now, this tends to show that the various discourses surrounding the lunatic institutions were, in fact, as I was saying, completely negotiated, with confinement being presented as a source of emancipation or, in fact, as alienating. So while this argument is valid for our whole period, the asylum model and the curative ideal it was hinged upon did undergo a crisis in the 1870s, 1880s onwards. So while the rhetoric of emancipation remained present, it was not the dominant one. At the turn of the century, this forced the asylum authorities to consider other asylum models. So in the last third of the 19th century, the idea of a potential increase of insanity emerged as the lunatic institutions all around the country became overcrowded. And this led to question the curative nature of asylum treatment. Now, the theme of fin de siècle decadence is a pattern in traditional historiography. This coincided with the end of the industrial preeminence of Great Britain, the competition coming from the US and Germany, the threats to the British Empire, and so on. In this context, the interpretation of the rising figures collected by the census and by the commissioners in lunacy led to debates. Was insanity actually increasing, or was this increase only apparent? The early interpretation of these figures in the 1860s, 1870s tended to lean towards an apparent increase of insanity, mainly resorting to a nosocomial argument, taking into account all the factors leading up to one's confinement. So the main argument to explain this increase were actually accumulation first. So it's not an increase, it's just that you have more patients in asylums in particular, and this was associated with the patient's increased life expectancy due to the better care and hygiene they received at the asylums. So that's one of the arguments. Political factors also played a part. At Rainhill, for example, Dr. Rogers criticized the 1874 4-shilling grant, which provided a four-shilling grant to local guardians to transfer the lunatics from workhouses to lunatic asylums. So this reinforced transfers, and this reinforced the competition between the asylum authorities and the local guardians, as they now accuse them of using the asylums, and I quote, as the dumping grounds for their unwanted cases. This might more generally express an overall and paradoxical successful integration of the asylum in the institutional landscape. As Henry Lave from Prestwich suggested in 1872, the greater appreciation of asylums by the public is a prominent factor in filling these institutions with the waifs and strays of society. Many are now sent who 20 years ago were either taken care of by private individuals or, being considered harmless, were allowed to remain at large. Now, Lave's designation of the waifs and strays is also grounded on social Darwinism or Spencerianism, which naturalized social relations. So the asylum came to assist those who were the least apt to normally adapt to society. And this is interesting here to see the paradoxical effect of progress, which is also a burden in a way. And Lay also seems to suggest changing definitions of insanity, or at least the tendency to confine cases who would not have been sent to the asylum a few decades earlier. Whatever the reason, in Lancashire, the pressure for accommodation was extremely problematic. In 1873, the new asylum at Whittingham was opened, but only 2 years after its opening, the superintendent already stressed that the asylum was filling up very quickly and encouraged local and county authorities to anticipate other solutions. The other existing asylums all built extensions, which profoundly altered the therapeutic spaces described earlier. So this is the evolution of patients for Lancaster, with the overall evolution between male and female patients. And the commissioners in Lunacy, who came to inspect the asylum in 1886, noted that the asylum had become, but I quote, a vast pile of buildings. At Prestwich and Rainhill, large buildings known as the Annex were erected in the 1880s. So this is the sharp increase that you can see here. So this is for Prestwich, and a similar pattern for Rainhill. And so this Annex more than doubled the number of insane patients. And at the turn of the century, there were about 2,000 patients in each of these Lancashire institutions, which had been built for 600 patients. So a shift is actually identifiable in the readings of the figures of insanity. In the 1880s, the commissioners in Lunacy and the census started to draw much more cautious conclusions than the ones they had established in the 1860s. This is also characteristic of the report for the Lancashire asylums in the 1880s, 1890s. At Rainhill, for instance, while Dr. Rogers had clearly rejected any actual increase of insanity, his successor in 1886, Dr. Wigglesworth, was much more cautious. In 1891, he thus admitted that the increase of insanity, although difficult to prove, was a possible interpretation. It appears to me, therefore, that with the data at present at our disposal, the existence of an increasing tendency on the part of the population at large to mental breakdown can neither be definitely affirmed nor definitely denied. These increasingly pessimistic approaches actually drew upon contemporary fears of degeneration. Now, an early proponent of degeneration, Benedict Augustin Morel, had defined it as une déviation maladive d'un type primitif, which was caused by a predisposition as well as external influences. And in the Lancashire Asylum reports, this was characterized by an increasing focus on hereditary etiologies. At Lancaster and Prestwich, both Dr. Cassidy and Dr. Lay insisted on prophylactic means to curb the influence of heredity. An individual who has inherited gout or stysis may, with proper care and attention, escape the effect of his inheritance, and even with the strongest constitutional taint, the path which leads to insanity may, in many cases, be avoided. By developing self-control and by strict attention to the natural laws of health and by a careful avoidance of those manifold influences which are known to be injurious to our moral nature, read alcohol in particular, individuals predisposed to insanity may do much to avert the calamity. Now, the syncretism between the hereditary argument and environmental etiology characterized the approach to increasingly common pathologies, such as general paralysis. However, it also fed much more, pessimistic approaches, and this tends to dominate the reports from Dr. Wigglesworth at Rainhill. As he analyzed the weight of heredity in his 1890 report, he used the Spencerian rhetoric of a struggle for existence to defeat the curative ideal of the asylum. There is indeed no sadder spectacle, nor one more calculated to excite our sympathies, than the lives of some of these individuals so heavily handicapped in the struggle for existence, who fighting, it may be manfully, against impossible odds, are nevertheless foredoomed to failure from causes over which they have no control and which no power on earth can alter. Truly indeed is it the case that the lives of individuals are largely conditioned for them by their ancestry, and their course of conduct testifies to the ever-present operation of that immutable law. The practical difficulties caused by the number of the insane at the asylums, together with the weight of hereditary etiologies, profoundly altered the perception of treatment in the asylums and encouraged the search for a new model. So, in 1892, the members of the Medical Psychological Society celebrated the centenary of the retreat. The report of the festivities suggested the victory of moral treatment. A few years earlier, a bronze statue of Philippe Pinel had been installed at the Salpêtrière and equally celebrated. Now, these commemorations might seem at odds with that anthropological pessimism we've just seen, but they do attest to the validity of the main pillars of moral treatment at the end of the 19th century: environment, work, entertainment, hygiene, more or less. It is interesting, then, to note how these principles now coexisted with concerns over a possible degeneration of the race. And both discourses, in fact, were integrated in the search for a new asylum model. At the start of the 20th century, the search for a new model was initiated by the local and county authorities in Lancashire. The Lancashire Asylums Board, a county authorities which had been created for the management of the insane, appointed an asylums committee in charge of visiting various institutions in Europe. This committee was composed by T.H. Jenkins, who was just chairing that committee, Dr. Cassidy from Lancaster, and Dr. Wigglesworth from Rainhill. Their reports recalled their visits to asylums in Germany, Belgium, and France. They commented upon their architecture, but also their management, so the cost, the number of accidents, of suicides, and so on. Among these institutions, the German ones seemed to catch their attention, in particular those composed of separate villas, an architectural plan which was well known but had been very little experienced in France or in the UK. As the authors of this report insisted on the benefits of the villa system, it is actually very interesting to note a continuity with the early ideals of asylum treatment with the retreat, associated with the retreat. The idea of home is in fact at the bottom of the villa colony system. By more complete subdivision and classification, those whose tastes, habits, interests, and occupations are similar might be enabled to associate and live together apart from others. So various congeries of an asylum would be divided, as it were, into separate congruous units. So the domestic ideal we referred to earlier was now integrated into a new ideal of a fragmented institution in sharp contrast with the block model recommended by Connolly in the 1830s. This coincided with the preeminence of the germ theories, which also implied hygiene and separation and responded to a need for a further classification of patients. These conclusions led the report to encourage the construction of a sixth Lancashire asylum on the villa model. It recommended separate villas for 40 patients each, in priority imbeciles and epileptics. A site was elected in Worley, in the northwest of the county. However, the villa plan was dropped for financial reasons. In the end, this model was adopted by the existing asylums, although it seemed to serve a social dimension more than a medical one. The extensions to the Lancaster Asylum at the start of the 20th century thus consisted in villas which were to be used by the middle-class patients at the asylum. In 1909, for example, the first villa that was built in Lancaster and bearing the name of the retreat in reference to the Quaker institution was dedicated to 50 patients paying for their own care. While the search for a new model did coincide with further attempts to improve the curative nature of these institutions, the priority seemed to have slightly shifted. Dr. Percival from Prestwich, as he was recalling the history of lunatic institutions in 1906, did introduce a distinction between the primary function of the asylum and its curative ambitions. Now, from the earliest times, the first object of an asylum for the insane has been the protection of the sane. As time went on, the religious teaching of the possession by devils became discredited. The lunatic received more and more humane treatment and was protected from himself. Later still, the cure of insanity began to seriously engage attention and has ever since been patiently and devotedly pursued by generations of physicians. Still, however, the chief duty of an asylum is and always will be the protection of the sane community and its chief aim and hope, the cure of the insane. The curative aspect, therefore, takes a secondary position here, while the asylum is primarily presented as an instrument of custody. In this perspective, the insane were no longer emancipated, but simply liberated within the constraints of the asylum. The priority had shifted to the protection of the community. And so this shift from the individual to the community is also characteristic of eugenics, which rationalized previous ideas on heredity and relied on the Platonic ideal of a pure race. Based on the misreading of genetical analysis, it assimilates social and biological characteristics. In this perspective, the pauper lunatics is thus racialized and jeopardizes the purity of the English race, both as a pauper and as a lunatic. Whether eugenics influenced practices within these asylums is actually far from certain. The rhetoric of eugenics, however, clearly influenced the discourses, but unequally so. Dr. Wigglesworth at Rainhill was particularly influenced by the terminology of eugenics. Dr. Cassidy's discourse at Lancaster was clearly hardening, but not as extreme as was not as extreme at, as Wigglesworth. And at Prestwich, Dr. Percival seemed, on the contrary, to take some distance from racial theories and eugenic solutions. The influence of eugenics gave more visibility to certain categories of patients in the reports, and in particular women. These commentaries coincided with complex definitions of motherhood during the Edwardian period, which notably underlined the role of mothers in the perpetuation of the race. In the asylums, therefore, the attention was drawn to marriages and more generally the sexuality of insane women. At Lancaster, for example, Dr. Cassidy regretted the birth of children inside asylums and insisted on the necessity of prophylaxy, as he warned his patients about the danger of having children in their state. Although undoubtedly influenced by the eugenic rhetoric, Cassidy actually moved away from the most radical line of eugenics, which rejected any form of advice. Segregation and education, in his perspective, seemed the preferred course of action. At Rainhill, Dr. Wigglesworth, together with Dr. Gemmell at Whittingham, actually, was way more heavily influenced by more drastic solutions. In 1911, Wigglesworth protested against the presence of women at the asylum who had just given birth when they were well known to be unstable. One of his patients, a 30-year-old woman suffering from mental problems after the birth of a second child, had already been admitted at Rainhill 7 years beforehand, when she was still single, he says. This case, and that of two other female patients in a similar situation, led him to a diatribe against the lunacy laws, which allowed these young women to have a free sexuality, which he deemed immoral. Sterilization had been rejected as an option a few years earlier, in particular by Dr. Percival at Presswich. But Wigglesworth, however, called for the responsibility of the state, underlining the necessity to, well, sacrifice insane women's individual liberties. And the villa model, or the villa and colony models, were then used as arguments to support his eugenic perspective. In properly constituted homes or colonies, the lives of such persons could be made comfortable and happy, and all reasonable liberty allowed, consistent with the absolute prohibition of all possibility of pregnancy. The state, in fact, should act in local parentis to such persons, both with the object of removing them from the stress of a social environment for which their natures are wholly unfitted, and to prevent the further misery to future generations by the propagation of their kind. Although the restriction of the liberty of the individual might produce hardship in certain cases, such a course is necessary in order to prevent hardship to a greater number of individuals in the future. And just as society has a perfect right to protect itself by permanently sequestrating those persons who have, during attacks of insanity, committed crimes of violence, even though they may have completely recovered, so also, in the cases before us, the restriction of the liberty of the mentally unfit is justifiable on the ground of the future well-being of society. His rhetoric is based on the move from an individual conception of emancipation, as liberation and de-alienation, to a collective one, the emancipation of the community, from alleged dangerous cases. Grounded on a utilitarian principle which aims at the happiness of the greatest number, his paternalistic argument also relies on contemporary contagionist discourses denouncing the moral and physical contamination of insanity. His discourse consequently points at a radical redefinition of the very meaning of confinement, and this was partially reflected by the 1913 Lunacy Law, which further extended the territories of public psychiatry to mental deficiency and facilitated forced institutionalization of the insane. We're struggling with this one. To conclude, and if we come back to our initial quotation from the ideal villa system in the Lancaster Asylum, our study allows us to fully deconstruct the apparent linearity conveyed in this description of the new villa building at the Lancaster Asylum. As we have shown, the rhetoric of emancipation at the core of the reformers' discourse from the end of the 18th century, while it suggested a uniform image of moral treatment as a sign of progress, actually failed to convey the pragmatic difficulties encountered in its application. This rhetoric also tended to turn the asylum into a total institution. Looking at its actual working and insertion in the institutional landscape, though, we were able to trace various superimposed discourses and practices which described confinement at the asylum as liberating or as alienating. The meaning of confinement actually changed over time, and why there is undoubtedly a continuity between the early discourses on moral treatment and the rhetoric used here, we have also established that this new model was integrated into other concerns, heavily relying on the eugenic ideals of the time. Now, this reflection on the asylum model can actually take us, I guess, much further. Since the deinstitutionalization movement in the 1990s, even earlier, actually reused the rhetoric of emancipation, applying it this time to the new ideal of care in the community, a discourse which is now being questioned by the supporters of more public facilities for the mentally ill. Thank you.
starting with David to start the discussion.
Thank you very much for a beautiful piece of research. Thank you all for inviting me today. It's really good to hear people thinking about history, because I guess we're in an age where historical reasoning outside of history, seems more and more dominant. So maybe something I wanted to say, or maybe a silly question, how do people feel, how do you feel, about the idea of history as a rejection of alienation? I'm thinking, for example, about the recent history of France, where people began talking about who and what Maréchal Philippe Pétain was, because of historians like Browning and others from the United States. So, one question, what do you think the history of asylums, the history of psychiatry is for? And is there not a very good reason to use historical studies to analyze what is happening now in the field of psychiatry, where you have, well, closing of hospitals, and this is much worse in England, but what's sad about France is the way you copy all the worst English ideas. You know, this really is disturbing. I told people not to do it, but they did it anyway. And you voted for Tony Thatcher. You know, that's very, very saddening. More difficult. Do you want to answer, or should I?
Yeah, I can take some notes. Good.
Fine. So I read your paper yesterday, and I thought I got a really good question for Claire. Is it not possible to combine social, psychiatric, and Marxist notions of alienation? I was thinking, even somebody who's not always very clever, the French writer who wrote The Alienated and the Proletariat, says at one point that the alienation of the proletariat looks like Eugene Minkowski's definition of morbid rationalism, which is a form of psychosis where people think within mathematical and spatial images. Second question that I thought was really good, but my cat jumped on the computer, so I lost part of it. Is there, do you think, a contradiction between the Browns, the Connollys, and others, and what Foucault says with this idea of alienism, psychiatry, basically being a bad, naughty thing to lock people up? Because, and this is something Postel quoted from Laurence Dubois' book, there is a kind of contradiction between people who say, well, you know, I've got problems with the devil, so can you take me to hospital, like in 1843, and people like Foucault who say, well, all of this is a big plot. This leads me to my third question, which is very British, but I guess concerns France as well. In England, as I remember, the Enclosures Act, does everyone remember what the Enclosures, yes, okay, that's good for you. The Enclosures Act in the 1830s and the 1840s pushed lots of people away from the countryside because they couldn't afford, literally, to stay on the land they had. And is there not a kind of natural movement of the disenfranchised proletariat towards either the asylum or the workhouse, according to what's going on? Because even early industrial Britain did not need all of its proletariat or sub-proletariat simply because it could get proletariat energy from the colonies. You see, England had all the soldiers, all the muscle it needed, and used the Irish to build canals, so on and so forth. And if they died because the work conditions were pretty awful, well, so much for that. Last little question. Do you see a link between eugenics, you mentioned, which you find all over Europe at different periods of time, even amongst so-called progressive people? Is there not a link between psychiatric thinking, eugenics, and the first Nazi law passed in 1933, which, as you remember, was quite extraordinary. 1933, instead of, you know, killing socialists or communists or anarchists, they say, well, no, we'll have a law for sterilizing all of those who are deaf, hysterical, manic depressive, and so on. And that is something that's kind of social engineering, kind of brings us back in a way to certain aspects of modern thought in France. Those are my little questions for you. Thanks again for a lovely paper.
Thanks. All right, I might actually start with the last one. and work my way to the other one. The link between eugenics and the Nazi law, I think, it's an extension. It's definitely an extension of that. And there are a lot, so I didn't have time really to explain that. But there were a lot of discussions already on sterilization at that time. And there was a royal commission which had been formed on the mentally unstable, just to consider whether that could be an option. And it ruled against it. And actually, there were also a lot of debates in Lancashire as well, with Rentoul in particular. I don't know if you know him, who was extremely in favour of sterilisation and like really advocate of sterilisation. And so it was rejected on the grounds of the ethical aspect, of course, but actually that was not the only consideration, and I suspect that might have been what happened in the 1930s afterwards, because one of the considerations was also to say, no, I mean, technically speaking, it's too complicated.
Okay.
And so I suspect maybe that's, why it was more doable in the 1930s, but that I might be wrong there, but there is definite continuity between the two, for sure.
Well, would you accept the idea that there's also a continuity between the psychiatric work of someone like Kraepelin and Nazi ideology? Because Kraepelin said, well, you've got to keep people in asylums because they're dangerous, basically. They're maybe left-wing, or they set fire to things, or whatever. But he also said that they were a drain on the resources, and the more money you spend on the alienated, the less money there is to build what he called a super race, of superior people. So this is something I'd like to hear you on.
Yeah, I think, so this is where actually I've written a little bit on it, between the connections between public health and, public health, which actually became public medicine at the beginning of the 20th century, and eugenics, because in fact there are a lot of connections between the two, and so you find a lot of common territories between the two. I'd say, I don't know if Kraepelin, because Kraepelin was also advocating, at least at the beginning, prophylaxis. He was a proponent of racial hygiene, as we would call it. But he also supported the idea that things could be reformed, in fact. So he was not as extreme as became afterwards, but he definitely influenced, I think, that basis. But again, it's also on the common grounds between, the very nature of public medicine and eugenics. And I think the two share very problematic common territory at the beginning of the 20th century. None of that answers your question, actually. So about another question. Yes, the effect of the Enclosures Act. Sort of pushing people towards workhouses and asylums. I think there is definitely something to it, and this is something which you can see in Lancashire in particular, because Lancashire was, very industrial. It was at the centre of the Industrial Revolution, and you can see that sort of traditional pattern for lunatic asylums. I mean, in terms of etiologies, it was sometimes argued that, because people used to be in the countryside, they were actually much, feeling much more, maybe they were more balanced or had more balanced lives. So the sort of romantic ideal of life in the countryside, basically, and that civilization, or the effects of civilization had actually destroyed their mental health. And alcohol is a very good example of that. So they came to, Liverpool, and then, they just got drunk and ended up in workhouses and lunatic asylums. So there is definitely... it's a use of the old pattern, from madness and civilization intertwined. It's definitely related to this. And you were mentioning the Irish, actually. The Irish are mentioned a lot because of Liverpool being also a sort of hub for Irish immigration. And so you find a lot of Irish patients, in fact, in asylums. And I found a lot of either contemporary writers or even comments in the asylum reports saying, they were healthy back in Ireland, green Ireland, and then they came here and were destroyed again by civilization. So I think there's definitely something to it connected to the change of life, connected to this. About Brown, Connolly, Foucault, and their contradictions, or is there a contradiction between them? In fact, they do have what they have in common. Foucault, Brown, Connolly is a total theory of the asylum, that is to say, the asylum as a unique place of cure. And Foucault, while trying to deconstruct the ideal of moral treatment, actually failed to consider the institutional context around the asylum himself. So I think they have that in common, the asylum as the unique place of cure and or management of the insane, depending on the on the perspective. What he says about the moral treatment being extremely, being in fact another form of restraint, but a moral one, was also justified to some extent with some thinkers. I can't remember his name now, but there was a thinker in the 1830s, you might know his name, who was mentioning the asylum as having to be a monocracy with a superintendent at the head, at the top, and sort of strong sense of hierarchy. And so all of this...
William Ellis did it, but I don't think it's the one
there's another one in particular. Exactly.
That you should embody something like that.
Yeah.
The head of the family also.
The head of the family, that's part of it as well, so hierarchy. So basically, he read that literally. But of course, Foucault uses this to deflect the therapeutic optimism. The problem, obviously, being that he turns this into the social control theory, while not considering the institutional context. I really think understanding how the asylum actually worked as an institution is crucial to the understanding of confinement, even. In the 19th century. So, yes. Do that. Yes. I guess that's pretty much it, but we can can say a few more things about this afterwards.
Well, the point Postel makes in his postface, he's quoting Laurence Dubois, where Laurence Dubois says Foucault couldn't be bothered to read Connolly, even.
Yeah.
Didn't look at Frame, because Frame was available to the English, to the Americans, easy to find on the internet, 1949, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he didn't actually look at the tradition in English psychiatry, the various conflicts in English psychiatry. He just, the way I see it, the way Postel sees it, is he took one model and said, well, must be the same for the British, you know.
Yeah, exactly. He expanded, and he talked about Europe having looked on the out of the selection.
You can't say that unless you've actually looked at the country's traditions and see what people said at the time. Yeah. I mean, that's what Postel argues anyway.
Yeah, well, I have to say, when I first read Madness and Civilization, that was for my master's, I think, and I remember having a look at his bibliography and being completely horrified. Mm. And I remember thinking, who is this guy? But actually, yeah, there is a real problem. I think he uses very interesting concepts, very useful concepts. And I think he referred to it himself as a toolbox. And that's how it should be used, in fact. But the basis for his argument is extremely problematic, indeed.
Thank you very much. Maybe two questions from the audience.
Yes, I've got a question by proxy, by population.